A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese, oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at schwabious.com.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
You are listening to a Hillbilly Horror Stories classic episode.
It's about to be a fun ride. Follow along, watch as we slide. Paranormal just hit the lights. Goosebumps all through the night. Mix in just a little bit of twang. That girl sure can't do a thing. Together, hillbillies go insane. Laugh so hard it'll hurt your brain. Podcast you won't ever change. These two here, they got the recipe. Sat on back and listen in to some of our darkest mysteries, ain't.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. And now here's your host, Jerry and Tracy Pauly, and their dog Ninja.
Do you get mad when listening to true crime? Well, so do I. If you want a weekly true crime podcast that says what you're thinking, then grab a beer and pull up a deck chair. This is Cambo from True Crime Island, another true crime podcast, and maintain the rage with me. Visit truecrimeisland.com, where you can download or stream each episode, plus there's links to iTunes and social media. Don't forget to delete your browser history. This is True Crime Island.
Everybody, and welcome to episode 71 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I am Jerry, and I'm joined by Tracy.
Hey, guys.
Getting ready for Christmas around here. This is our last episode before the Christmas night episode, and we got a few little tricks in our bag for that special show.
I have a bag?
Yeah, it's Santa's bag.
Ooh-wee.
Yeah, got to be excited about Santa's sack.
Hey, you know I am.
So, wanted to touch on a couple things real quick. Obviously, we want to thank all of our military from all over the world, no matter what country you're serving, and all of our first responders out there and civil servants. Thank you so much for everything you do.
God bless you guys. I know it's hard being away from your families, but no, we are always thinking about you all.
Next week's show, we're probably going to feature, I know Andrea is supposed to come back on. You guys love it when she comes on and tells the stories. Mm-hmm. And she's supposed to come on. She's got something that is going to knock your socks off.
Good.
So we're trying to put together some times this week. And then we also have a surprise from, well, I'm not going to tell you what that one is. You'll just have to be surprised as part of your Christmas gift. So that one you'll have to wait on. But I can tell you there is another pretty well-known podcaster that is going to start doing a small segment occasionally with us.
Oh, yay.
About true crime facts. And I'll just leave as to who this mystery person is until next week, so it can be your little Christmas surprise. But it's going to be fun. This has been in the works for a couple weeks.
I wonder who it is.
You probably really don't know who it is. But
I like surprises.
Yeah, I do too. So yeah, I think it's going to be a very cool Christmas episode, and we're going to do some Christmas stories, some I guess you could say horror Christmas stories. So we'll see how that works. But tonight is tonight, and what we've got is a couple of stories for you. Both of these stories are more creepy true crime than paranormal, but I think you're going to like both of them. And the first story we're going to do, I'm going to thank Justin Rimmel from Mysterious Circumstances, one of our Bomb Pod brothers. He actually gave me the idea for this story. He thought it would fit really well, and then when I read up on it, it did really fit well. We could go ahead and announce that on April 14th, if you're in the Cincinnati, Ohio area, myself and Tracy are going to join Justin from Mysterious Circumstances and the guys Nick and Rob from Brohio for a live show up there. We still haven't nailed down the actual place yet, the venue for this, but we just know it's going to be all three of us, and it's going to be on a Saturday night on April 14th, and that should be a fun time. So if you're in the area, that'd be a good time to catch up.
Yeah.
At the end of the show tonight, we've got two really good stories for you, and then at the end of the show, we have got an interview with our buddy Lee Sowell from Where, Tracy?
Don't break the oath.
They Andy couldn't join us, but Lee came on to talk about how they fixed all their audio, and now they're some special guests and stuff they have on. But mainly he came on because he's going to tell us a couple of scary stories.
Good.
One of which is in our neck of the woods, and I didn't know anything about it. So it's pretty cool. So that's what we got going for you tonight. So let's jump right in here, and let's start trying to scare you a little bit. This first story takes place February 7th, 1981. Picture this. You got a 29-year-old African-American man by the name of Leroy Carter Jr. He's walking through the Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. He's looking for a place to sleep. He finds what he thinks is the perfect place to sleep in a nice little secluded spot next to Alvord Lake. Unfortunately for Mr. Carter, he was not going to wake up from this sleep.
You mean like Rip Van Winkle?
Well, no, I don't think we mean like him, because he actually woke up from his sleep. It just took like a long time.
Oh.
This guy, unfortunately, was not going to wake up. Oh. He was brutally murdered.
Oh, no.
The papers didn't even really say much about it as far as the murder goes. It was just more like kind of a small blurb, which unfortunately kind of happens with the homeless people a lot of times.
You know, that's so sad. I mean, their life is already sad enough, but they can't even be acknowledged in a proper way.
I mean, most of the stories that they had, like I said, was just basically, you know, was based on the fact that a homeless man was found dead in the park. What made this case, though, different was how Carter was actually found. He had been found decapitated, and the evidence actually pointed to voodoo.
Oh, my gosh.
So let's learn a little bit about the area, okay? Because this area is actually pretty rich in history. Even though you might not know it right off the bat, when I start talking about some of the stuff, you'll know what I'm talking about. Alvord Lake actually sits at the edge of Golden State Park, which is across from the iconic Haight Ashbury District. Okay. And some people pronounce it Haight, some people pronounce it Haight, but it's H-E-A-I-G-H-T.
Oh, okay.
So, but most people say Haight. So Haight Ashbury District. Now, this is actually the same area where all the hippies congregated, like in the 60s and the 70s, the peace, love. Everybody, you know, everybody talked about going to San Francisco.
Yeah.
This is where everything happened at. Kind of like, you know, Woodstock's where all the music happened
at.
Oh,
dang. Well, so it's a cool place to go.
Yeah, this was a cool place. And it basically, the Haight Streets was just full of teenagers and young people just trying to find their purpose. And
in life, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that pretty much was it. And that's where this thing first came to prominence. Now, in the 70s came, drugs became a lot more prominent there, and the peace and love segment kind of dissipated into the heroin devastation, and drugs and crime kind of took over.
What a shame.
So like I said, it went from free love to epidemics of overdoses, crimes, and kind of horrible. So in the 80s, the area kind of made a comeback. The new generation was here. There was a very growing and proud homosexual community that developed right there. And then it was a scene that had a lot of comedy in the area. This is where Robin Williams got his start. This is where Whoopi Goldberg got her start. So it was kind of a big deal. So you started, you know, 80s, it just saw a whole different.
80s were the best. 80s were the best year ever.
That's when you turned like 40, right?
Oh, you dog. But that's when my hair was high to heaven.
So you had all that going on, then you had a mixture of white upper class, middle class families there. So this was the resurgence of the area. Now, when I found this out, I thought this was kind of funny, but the part of the resurgence that made it complete, a McDonald's opened at the far west end of the district.
Oh, man, that's when you know.
But in the 80s, you wouldn't think that, you would have thought there probably would have already been a McDonald's in the 80s there. Okay. But I guess.
That's probably not true, because I know when in the 80s, we had to go to Florence for our McDonald's, okay?
And nobody listening knows where that is.
I know this, but I'm just saying, my point I'm trying to make is, back in the 80s, back in the day, when we, going to McDonald's was a big deal.
Right.
I mean, because we didn't have one where I lived in Dry Ridge at all. So, I mean, it was a big deal to go, you know, 3 or 4 exits down the interstate.
Well, I don't doubt what you're telling me, but what I'm saying is there's a big difference between Dry Ridge and Florence, Kentucky not having a McDonald's. Than not having one close to this place in San Francisco.
No,
San Francisco is a huge city.
Well,
I just expected them to have a lot more McDonald's around.
Oh, yeah, a lot more. Well, I totally get that. But good for them.
So just across the street from that McDonald's that was built is the Golden Gate Park where this tragedy happened. It's a popular tourist destination, but it's got a lot of thugs and junkies and stuff like that. So because they're searching for fixes, the cops would kind of tell the tourists, probably a park to stay away from.
Yeah, don't go there.
Now, Leroy Carter Jr. was actually a man who was, he'd survived the Vietnam War. Unfortunately, like a lot of Vietnam vets, he came home and basically had no direction, no guidance, and ended up homeless.
No, that's so flipping wrong. I can't stand it.
I know.
That's so damn wrong.
There were so many people from the Vietnam War, at least in the United States, there were so many people that came back that they just, total lack of respect.
Yeah. Oh my
it was
gosh.
Almost like, you know, it was their fault that they were there. I mean, and it wasn't.
No.
A lot of them guys didn't want to be there either.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, you know.
Well, God bless every one of them. It's just a sad thing.
So he actually found, you know, comfort being in the streets. He you know, his used to surviving day to day when he was over in Vietnam. And he felt like, you know, if he could survive, you know, every day in the jungles over there, surviving the streets of San Francisco was no big deal. That's what he was used to. That's what he was comfortable with. So he didn't mind being homeless. Now, Carter wasn't perfect, obviously, like a lot of people. He committed some small petty thefts and stuff like that, some small crimes that basically it was just to try to make ends meet to get by. He'd steal some food or maybe he'd, you know, but he wouldn't like robbing people and stuff like that. But he would, you know, a lot of stealing of food and stuff like that to just try to make it day to day. And there was nothing about his life that seemed to be a link to the occult or voodoo or anything like that, which makes the story all that more strange. Now, so from the outside looking in, it just seems like that he just picked the wrong place to sleep.
Aww.
Wrong place, wrong time. So what made it look like an act of voodoo? That's the question because, you know, we've covered that's what they thought, but we haven't really covered why. So when the police found Carter's body, he was actually still in a sleeping bag by the lake. His head was missing. It was sliced clean off.
Oh, God.
There were 2 corn cobs and a chicken wing that was jammed into his severed neck.
Now, see, that's going to make me cry. You can't say that stuff. That is terrible.
Well, are you okay?
No.
I'm sorry, baby.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
That just really makes me sad.
It's all right. 50 yards away from his body, the police found the mutilated remains of several dead chickens. The case was assigned to San Francisco Police Department Inspector Sandy Gallant, and Sandy actually had just finished heading up the department's investigation to Jonestown, the whole Guyana tragedy with Jim Jones down there, and there was some connections to that to San Francisco, and she headed up that. So she kind of became an expert in cults and ritualistic murders and stuff like that from that experience she got from that. So that's why they gave her the job. Now, many cults in the area were kind of created from the communal lifestyle of the 60s and 70s, which basically meant when these hippies and stuff were during the whole peace and love thing, a lot of them would get together and they would all live like a bunch of them, 10, 12, 14, 15 people in the same house. And
yeah,
they had that. It almost had an occult like feel, but they didn't really bother anybody. I mean, they just were just living together and they wanted the same thing and they all stuck together, but they weren't violent or anything like that. But by this time, most of these things had kind of dissolved or had learned to live peacefully amongst everybody else. And a few of them, though, did become cults. So that's why they wanted to look into this. Now, this didn't look like the usual cult activity of this area. There's kind of signs and stuff like the whole, you know, Manson type stuff. That's what you expected to see in the Southern California areas.
Maybe they were more like gypsies or something.
Yeah, well,
maybe
it's just,
not to that extent.
It's just that voodoo wasn't something you saw in San Francisco. That was more of a New Orleans or a Florida or what have you type deal. So the dead chickens things pointed to something not common at all in San Francisco area. And so she kind of turned to the one of her friends, which was actually Dade County, Florida coroner Charles Weddle. Now, Charles Weddle was actually the country's leading expert in Santeria, which is why we played Sublime Santeria at the bottom. Now,
I love that song, by the way.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with Santeria, I thought I'd give you just a little bit of background on it. Santeria was actually brought to the New World on slave ships. It began with the Yoruba people in Africa. They were an African tribe that lived actually in the central part of what they call North Central Nigeria today.
Oh, okay.
So that's how it kind of got started. It developed in the Caribbean and became more and more of what it is, where it merged with some elements of Christianity before coming to the southern coast of the U.S. And one of the more famous things we've talked about, well, you didn't, but Ricky and I did, Robert the Doll, that was what the young ladies that came from the Bahamas, the Robert the Doll's family, had gotten these slaves from the Bahamas, and they're the ones that actually raised Robert. And they were caught practicing Santeria in the backyard, and she banished them and left. So the slaves had to leave. She kicked them out and sent them back to the Bahamas. And before she did, one of the slaves actually made Robert the Doll and gave it to Robert.
Oh, how interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's one of the more interesting parts of the Santeria. So, but as far as Santeria, though, sacrifice plays a major role. And most of the use of live chickens, but there are some underground sects that will search for human bodies.
Oh.
And that's kind of what we had going on here. So Weddle informed Gallant that the ritual wasn't complete yet. So even though they got this, the guy that's decapitated and this other stuff done to him, if it was actually Santeria, the killer would actually return to the scene of the crime 42 days later and return the victim's head.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So they spent the next 41 days sifting through any kind of evidence that might be able to help them, and it went nowhere. So Gallant decided that she knew that day 42 was rapidly approaching, and on March 22nd, 1981, Gallant and her partners were back at the park waiting to see what would happen. So they staked out the spot where his Carter's body was found, and despite them being there, the killer found his way back and placed the head in the weeds right next to Alfred Lake.
Oh my gosh.
Without ever being seen. So now he had escaped from the scene of the crime twice, with cops right there watching. So the killer had completed the ritual and gotten away again. The head gave police no new leads, and the case went cold. So Gallant became basically an outspoken opponent of the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. She felt like that Dungeons & Dragons actually led teens and young people into suicide and cult activity. And she used to give lectures warning the parents of the dangers of it and occult murders and suicide and all that stemming from the game. And Leroy Carter Jr. was buried at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia, which was pretty cool.
Yes, very nice.
Leroy Carter Jr.'s murder is still currently unsolved to this day.
Wow, unsolved.
So, I thought that was kind of
I'm just glad he got laid to rest.
Yeah, and it's cool they took him all the way, even though he was out in San Francisco, all the way on the other side of the country. They took him to Arlington, because Arlington's a pretty prestigious place for the military to be laid to rest. That's where President Kennedy is. That's where several other famous people are, but...
I'd like to apologize to everybody. I didn't mean to have that breakdown, kind of, but that, I don't know, that just tore my heart out knowing that that happened to that guy. And I just want to apologize for that. Sorry about it.
And that's why we can't do true crime.
Oh, gosh. That just killed my soul.
So the other story that we wanted to do. So once again, thank Justin Rimmel from Mysterious Circumstances for giving us that cool story. I don't know if this is going to be any easier on you than what that one was. So,
well, I'll be all right.
All right. This one is actually one of the more, I want to say curious, but I'm going to say more confusing stories in true crime history.
Okay.
So this actually is the murder in room 1046. Ninja is extremely loud tonight.
Sorry, guys.
So this happened on January 2nd, 1935. A man checked into room 1046 of the Hotel President in Kansas City, Missouri. And they said that he kind of looked like he was between the ages of 20 and 35 years old. Mm-hmm. He had a cauliflower ear and a scar on his head. So they had a pretty damn good description of what this guy looks like. He signed in as Roland T. Owen. Okay, and that's going to come into play a bunch. He didn't have any kind of bag, so when the bellboy actually took him up to his room, all he had was a comb, a brush, and a toothpaste. That's it.
Nope. A toothbrush?
Well, it said a comb, a brush, and toothpaste. I'm assuming the brush had to be a toothbrush.
Okay, good. Well, at least he had the most important thing with him to brush his teeth. Good job.
This case would soon become one of the most bizarre in U.S. history. So, these things were eerie from the very beginning as far as things that happened in this. It started with him settling into the room. So the maid actually came up on the day that he checked in to start cleaning, which is, I mean, how do they come in and start cleaning the day you check in?
Well, I don't understand that. Well, it makes no sense.
This was back in the 30s. They obviously did stuff different because you're going to see they come back to check for towels and stuff like every 20 minutes, it seems like. But so she says that when she comes in, he's actually sitting in a chair. He's got all the shades drawn, and there's only one small little light on in the corner, just barely enough to give any light in the room. But he's just sitting in the chair. Uh-huh. And so she comes in and he told her to, she's cleaning everything. And he told her to leave the door open because he was expecting a friend to come by.
Okay.
So no big deal. He left the room before she was actually done. So she finished up and he left. So she finished up what she's done, left the door open like he said. Later, she said that he seemed kind of nervous, either nervous or scared. But she just couldn't really put her finger on it. But there was just something about
it. Yeah, something off with him. Mm-hmm.
So she comes back a few hours later to replace the towels. And she found him laying on the bed, completely clothed, with all the lights off. So she thought that was strange. Once again, he's in the dark, but he's laying in the bed, but he's got all of his clothes on. Just kind of laying there, chilling. She noticed that there was a note on the table that said, "Don, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait." She don't really understand why the note's there because he's laying on the bed. Who's the note for?
Oh.
So 10:30 in the morning on January 3rd, the same maid, she actually returned to clean the room. She found the door locked from the outside. So she's thinking, okay, he's gone, obviously. Because the door's locked. And I guess, you know, this is back in the 30s, so I'm assuming you could lock the door from the inside, the outside. Where now, you just got the keys in it. But she could tell it was locked from the outside. She opens it with her pass key, and she assumes that Owen's gone. But instead, she finds him sitting there in the dark. So then the first question is, if he's sitting there in the dark, how'd the door get locked on the outside? Because you can't lock it on the outside if you're still on the inside.
So somebody else had a key.
Somebody else locked the door from the outside while he was in there.
He must like the dark a lot. Maybe he had a migraine.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. So a few seconds later, she said the phone rang. And she overheard the conversation. And he picks it up and he says, "No, Don, I don't want to eat. I'm not hungry. I just had breakfast." And then she said a few seconds later, he reiterated, "I'm not hungry.
Don't make me tell you again."
Yeah, more or less. Later that day, she returns to change up the towels. That's what I'm saying. In like a day and a half period, she done came in to change the towels twice.
Now, see,
she done came in to clean the room twice.
Yeah, that ain't the world today. You have to use the same towel like four different times to save the water.
I know it. So Yeah, and they pretty much tell you in the hotels, hang the towel. Unless you see green mold and smell mildew, keep using the same towel.
Oh, gosh.
So when she gets there to the door, there's time to change the towels out. And she knows there's no towels because she's already cleaned the room.
Yeah.
So she knows there's no towels in there. And she gets to the room and she hears two male voices talking. Mm-hmm. And she knocks on the door and they say, who is it? And she said, I need to switch the towels out. And she said that a kind of a gruff.
Like a gruff voice?
Voice said, we don't need any towels. Which she knew was a lie because she knew there was no towels in there. But either way, she took her hint and she left.
But I wonder why she didn't ask him when he was sitting in the dark. Sir, are you okay? Why are you sitting in the dark?
I don't know. I guess people back then mind their own business.
Oh, dang.
So, that's my thought.
Yeah.
So, a lot of this, as far as what went on the rest of the afternoon, is kind of a complete mystery. There's not a whole lot known about what happened. But I know that later that night, a motorist by the name of Robert Lane said he picked up a hitchhiker several blocks from the hotel. He said it was cold, but the man was only dressed in pants and a t-shirt. He said he had a deep scratch on his arm, and he asked Lane if he could take him somewhere where he could get a cab. I don't know why he wouldn't have just asked him to take him to the hotel.
Well, duh, that is a dumb question. What the heck?
But that's what he said. So Lane said, hey, it looks like you're having a bad night. And a man said, I'll kill that son of a bitch tomorrow.
Oh, dang.
That's what this Roland Owen said. Mm-hmm. Now, how do we know that this was Roland Owen? I'm not going to tell you right this second, but it will come to light later that that's who this was in the cab. So the next morning at 7 a.m., the operator at the hotel room noticed that the phone in 1046 was off the hook. So she sends the bellboy up, Randolph Probst, which was the original bellboy who took him up when he noticed that he just had no bags and the comb and all that stuff. He gets up there and he notices that the door's locked and he's going to try to come in, right? And so he can't come in. So he knocks and he says, hey, I'm here to see about the phone. And he hears a voice from inside say, okay, come on in. And he tried to come in, but it was locked.
The door was locked. Right. Yeah.
So he knocks on the door again and he says, hey, I can't come in because the door's locked. And the voice tells him, come on in and turn the lights on.
Oh, well, hello. Did you not hear me say the door was locked?
Yeah, once again, he can't do that. So this guy, you know, the bellboy, he's assuming he's drunk. And so he knocks a few more times and then he just finally just yelled in there, hey, can you please hang the phone up?
Oh, yeah.
So that was kind of the end of it for the minute. So a little bit later, they noticed that it's still not on the hook. So they sent a different bellboy up. This bellboy lets himself in with a passkey. And he just walks in. He never turns a light on. He just walks in.
Uh-huh.
And using the light from the hallway, he sees that the phone's off the cradle. It's been knocked over or something, the stand where the phone was. So he goes over there and he hangs the phone up. Now, he does notice that the guy laying there in the bed, completely naked.
Butthole naked.
Butthole naked. Assumes he's drunk. And with a little bit of light that's in there, said it to look like there's a little bit of darkening around him in the sheets.
Oh, my gosh.
This apparently didn't raise any kind of alarm or anything to the guy.
Well, he thought maybe he threw up or something.
Right. I don't know what he thought it was. But I guess he maybe just thought it was just the lights playing tricks on him.
With his eyes, yeah.
So he gets everything done. He goes back downstairs. Problem solved. A few hours later, the phone was off the hook again.
Oh, my gosh.
They sent Probst, the first bellboy who didn't accomplish anything, back up. And he used his passkey to open the door, and then he was shocked at what he saw.
Oh.
He said within 2 feet of the door, he saw Roland Owen. He was on his hands, his elbows, and his knees. So picture that. It's almost like you're just, you know, almost in a doggy style type thing. Right. But instead of your hands down, you got your knees. He's on his knees, his elbows, and he's holding his head in his hands.
Wait. Like with his hands grasped just around his face or
right,
like
right. I know that's kind of hard to picture, but
well my gosh, what's
he's basically on all fours, but instead of having his palms down, he's got his elbows and he's holding his head. So if you think about it, you can picture it.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's down there and he notices that he's covered in blood, so he flips the lights on. And when he flips the lights on, there was blood all over the blankets and the sheets, which was the discoloration that the other guy saw.
Oh, that's what he saw?
There was blood on the ceiling. There was blood on the walls, and there was blood all in the bathroom.
Oh, dude.
They call the cops. Cops come in. They see that he had been tied up, tortured. His head had been beat several times with a blunt object. He'd been stabbed several times. He had a collapsed lung. That would be found out at the hospital later. So they knew something horrible happened. Later on, the doctor actually checked him out in the hospital. They had determined that he had been tortured for 6 or 7 hours.
Oh, man.
And so he sat there with all those hours with that.
So then when he was saying, come in and turn on the lights, I guess he was probably asking for help. Like, hello.
He probably didn't have a clue what was going on, but it had already happened. Because like I said, he'd had multiple blows to the head.
Oh, my gosh.
So when the cops asked him what happened, he said that he fell and hit his head on the bathtub.
Okay.
Which would have been kind of hard to just do, considering he had multiple stab wounds and blood on the ceiling and blood on the, you know.
I wonder why he didn't want to say.
I don't know. But it could just be he probably was just out of it, is my guess.
Yeah.
And so they go ahead and take him to the hospital. Unfortunately, he slipped into a coma and died later that night.
Aww.
Now, if you think that's strange, well, you haven't heard anything yet. Because the strangest is just getting ready to start happening. So the authorities scoured the room, okay? Mm-hmm. They're trying to find anything and everything they can, some kind of evidence. The only thing they really found was a label from a necktie, an unsmoked cigarette, a woman's hairpin, 2 water glasses, one of which had 4 prints on it, which was possibly a woman, a safety pin, and a small bottle of sulfuric acid. Now, I don't know what they would have used the sulfuric acid for, but...
Well, if that was a woman, her lips would have been all over that wine glass.
So, well, it didn't say it was a wine glass, it just said it was a glass.
Oh, well, it doesn't matter. It'd still be on there.
The most baffling part was yet to come, though. The police tried to confirm his identity because they were told when he checked in, he was Roland Owen from L.A. Well, they couldn't find a Roland Owen that matched that description anywhere from L.A. So, apparently, he checked in with a fake name. Why? Nobody knows.
I don't know, but it's kind of a cool name when you say it.
It's a lot better than what his real name turns out to be. So, the body was actually brought to a local funeral home and publicly displayed. They were hoping to find somebody that would say, hey, I know who this is.
Oh, yeah, I know who this is.
And they went ahead and even put it in the paper, everything that they knew about the case, hoping somebody would come forward. Well, several people came in to the viewing and said that it looked really familiar, but... it was under different names. Everybody knew him as somebody else. And police were prepared to just bury him in a what they call a potter's field, which is where they bury people that, you know, they don't have any family. They don't know who they are. They were going to list him as a John Doe. And that was just going to be the end of it. Well, the funeral home got a very strange phone call. The phone call asked if the burial could be delayed until the money arrived to cover a proper funeral. And the guy went on to say that Roland was his real name and that he was engaged to his sister.
Ah.
And he wanted him.
Oh, not Roland's sister.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. I was about to take another bad turn.
To this guy's sister. And he wanted him buried in Memorial Cemetery where he could be close to his sister.
Oh.
So.
Well, that was a nice gesture.
Yeah, it's still kind of odd, though, that somebody's just going to make this call
as to who really he random. Is
and just offer to pay for the funeral and all that stuff. So, as he was on the phone, he just said that Roland got into a jam and that police were on the wrong track. So, it just makes the phone call that much more odd. So, the money actually arrived anonymously. It was delivered by special delivery, and it was in a rolled-up newspaper. Cash in a rolled-up newspaper.
Wow, that's crazy. That's different.
So, they laid the body to rest in Memorial Park Cemetery under the name Roland Owen, which the caller insisted was real. What's even more mysterious, or equally mysterious, I'm going to say it's even more, is money showed up at a florist to buy a bouquet of roses. It was a specific amount. It was like 10, I can't remember, 10 or I think it was 13 certain amount of roses. It was 12 or 13 roses of a certain type of roses.
Oh.
And they wanted it to put over top of
the gravesite.
Yeah, the gravesite.
Oh, okay.
Because it was going to be done at the cemetery.
Oh, I gotcha.
But it came with a card that said, "Love forever, Louise."
Oh. Okay.
Now.
Well, it sounds to me like somebody's conscience were.
Somebody's, but it just, you know, it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. So now, a year later, 1936, a woman in Birmingham, Alabama, she's sitting there and she's reading the account of what this murder was in a magazine called American Weekly. And she starts thinking and she says, man, the dead man listed here might be my friend's missing son. So she goes over to her and says, hey, I think we might have found your son. And she starts looking into it. Well, her son, Artemis Ogletree.
What? Excuse me, what?
Artemis Ogletree.
Oh.
Was his name. And he had left home in April of 1934. Well, he said he wanted to see the world and all that kind of stuff. She kind of went up to the Kansas City, and she confirmed that Roland Owen was indeed her son, Artemis Ogletree.
Oh.
Keep in mind, the man confirmed that he was this guy.
Yes.
So there's already a big contradiction. But this mystery is far from over. So in the early 2000s, 70 years after all this happened, a guy by the name of Dr. John Horner, who was doing some research and stuff like that at the Kansas City Public Library, he received an anonymous phone call. It was from out of state. And it said that this guy that made the phone call said that he was doing, he had a client, I guess, that was elderly that passed away. So he's going through some boxes and stuff that belonged to him. And he found a bunch of clippings, newspaper clippings, about the story.
Yes.
But he also said he found an object that was mentioned in those newspaper clippings. And then when Dr. Horner asked him what kind of object was it, the guy hung up and he never heard from him again.
I wonder what it was.
Well, no, nobody knows. So So let's start talking about, I guess, some things that kind of tie this case together a little bit. For example, Gene Owen, which is no relation by any means, she was given room 1048 next door the same night.
Yes.
Okay. She said she was continually bothered by sounds of a male and a female voice arguing violently in the other room. So she could hear this arguing back and forth. Now, supposedly there was a party going on in like 1056 or something like that.
Room,
And so there, it was possible that that came from there, but she was sure that it came from next door. She also said that she heard gasping, which she assumed was just somebody, you know, drunk or whatever the deal was. She actually thought about calling the front desk, but didn't.
So she could actually make out the words they were saying when they were arguing?
I don't know if she could make it out. She could just tell that it was a male and a female voice. Now, there also was a guy named Charlie Blocker. He was the graveyard elevator shift guy. So he operated the elevator at the nighttime. He said that there was a woman that came in. He took her to the 10th floor, and she was looking for room 1026, which is close. It's 1026, which she was looking for.
Yeah.
But 1046 was Roland's own. So they think that maybe she was looking for his room, and she was confused. So she gets there and she tells the guy, hey, I'm at room 1026. I can't find the gentleman that I'm supposed to be seeing. Now, according to the elevator operator, this was a lady who frequented the hotel a lot into a lot of different men's rooms.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
He said that she called back and said she couldn't find the man. Could he come back to the 10th floor and pick her back up? He does. He then takes her down to the lobby. About 15 minutes later, she's got a guy. They get back on the elevator. They go up to the 9th floor. And he lets them off. And then eventually, that lady left the hotel at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And then the other guy left like 15 minutes later that she was with.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't know if she has any connection at all, or if the man or the woman had any connection at all to the case, or if it was just random. But it's odd that they were there that night. And the lady said she heard a man and a woman arguing in that room, and then all this took place.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody really knows if they had anything to do with the case or not, but the elevator man seemed to think they were very suspicious after knowing the facts. Now, at the funeral home, there were some strange occurrences, too. I told you there were people coming in and visiting to try to figure out if they knew him or not know him. Well, one of the guys that came in said that he had just stayed at a different hotel, a very high-class hotel, the night before, under the name of Eugene Scott. And before that, the St. Regis Hotel. So he was going in and out of all these different hotels in Kansas City for whatever reason. So it just doesn't make sense. And you add in all of his constantly being in the dark and his strange phone calls to the guy Don and all that stuff. Who's Don? And you know, nobody really can find out. Now, you had several bartenders in the area that said they had seen him around town with two different women at the same time.
Sounds like it was a whore.
It does sound like that. But they also said he always had a different name. That they didn't know him by the Roland Owens. Yeah. They knew him by other names. Now, 9 days later, a wrestling promoter by the name of Tony Bernardi visited. And he said that Roland had shown up to him and tried to become a wrestler. He wanted to, which makes sense because he had a cauliflower ear.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
A lot of like high school, college, amateur wrestling, not professional wrestling, a lot of them have cauliflower ears just from the wrestling. But he showed up, so he probably had a wrestling background.
Yeah.
So he showed up and wanted to be a wrestler, but his name was Cecil Warren, is what he told him his name was.
I don't even know how he could keep up with all those names anyway.
Apparently he couldn't. So the question is, was this maybe a love triangle gone bad? I mean, was Don and this girl and him all, you know, part of something nefarious going on? And then in the spring of 1935, after Roland died, three typed letters actually arrived at his mom's house. And the first thing odd about that is Roland didn't know how to type. Mm-hmm. But these letters came. And the mom said that after she got them, like I said, obviously they came after he'd passed away, which was odd. And the fact that he didn't know how to type. She said the letters didn't come across, the base of the letters, it didn't have that same vibe.
Oh, so as if the letters Roland were from him.
It supposedly they were from Roland.
Oh.
But she says she knows they weren't from him.
Oh, so she could just tell.
So who sent the letters? Because she said she could tell by the writing that it wasn't the way he would have talked.
What's in the letters? I wonder.
Well,
do you know?
A couple of different things. She actually received a strange phone call from somebody named Jordan. And Jordan said that he was living in Egypt and he had met a real wealthy girl in Cairo and that's where he had married her. But we both know that wasn't the case because she already knew that her son was dead. So I don't know why this guy would bother to call to tell her all this stuff.
What in the world?
And the Jordan guy said that he had saved his life, that her son had saved his life in Egypt. But he had never been to Egypt. And in the letters, they all stated something similar. They were all these different things about how he was living abroad and all this stuff. But she had already confirmed by the pictures and everything that her son was, in fact, Roland Owen that was dead up there.
Well, that is bizarre.
And that is pretty much all we have on the case, except for one little last detail that I thought was very interesting. Her son, Roland, who passed away, her son was Artemis, he was 17 years old.
What? 17?
17. So all this that happened was a 17-year-old boy.
Well, wow.
So I thought that was a really cool story.
That is very cool.
That's about as bizarre as it gets.
That is pretty bizarre.
And like I said, I know neither one of these stories we did were paranormal.
Yeah.
But I thought they both had facets of what the hell. So to this day, nobody knows who Don is. You know, was that the guy with the gruff voice?
Yeah, so nobody's ever solved that murder
Well, I mean, it's the same murder.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm
just saying. But nobody knows who Don is.
Yeah.
Nobody, you know, was that the guy that was up there with the lady of the evening that was looking for the room? Was that Don? Nobody knows because the maid, as many times as the maid stuck her nose in there, she never saw Don. But, you know, and then you've got to deal with the lady who said, hey, there was a man and woman up there arguing at night. So who was the woman? You know, and then you got the caller who calls the funeral home and says that Roland was an ex-fiance to his sister and he wants him in the cemetery so he would be close to his sister. So does that mean his sister was dead? Was his sister Louise? Mm-hmm. Was that why it said, you know, forever Louise?
Yeah, I feel like Don has a very guilty conscience.
You know, or did Roland do something to Louise, and that's why she's dead. And this was Don's way of getting even. But that doesn't sound right because he seemed to be friendly with Don.
Well, I don't know how a 17-year-old has all this experience.
I don't either.
Doing all this stuff.
And then at the other hotels.
I would have never in a million years would have known he would be 17.
The other hotels that he stayed in, they were saying that he had stayed there with another man. So, I mean, was there something of that going on, which mm-hmm. in the 30s wouldn't have been the most acceptable thing in the world? You know, so who knows? This thing has so many loose ends and nothing has ever been tied up.
I mean, it sounds like he enjoyed himself. Well, he could.
He probably didn't enjoy that last day.
Well, I'm sure he didn't enjoy that day.
I'm wondering where the guy's money came from to be able to stay at all these expensive hotels. Mm-hmm. And because there was even the bellboy, the original bellboy said that he was going to stay in the hotel that I'd mentioned before. I can't remember the name of it right off the bat, but he was going to stay there, but it was like $5 a night and it was too expensive.
Oh, my gosh.
But the thing of it is, he actually did stay there. Because they had already got proof that he had stayed there the night before.
I don't know. That is a messed up story, is all I know.
Yeah, so I thought that was a pretty cool story, and I'm glad we did it. And it was one of the more fascinating stories that I've looked into. So, but I wish they would eventually find out what went on just so there could be closure. But, I mean, everybody involved with it has since passed. I mean, hell, that was 1935. So
yeah.
It's been a long time ago.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's what we got for you as far as that story. Now I want to do play this interview for you with Lee. And like I said, it's a little bit of an interview just about the show, but it's really fun because Lee tells us a couple of paranormal stories. So your paranormal stories are coming. They're just not coming from me. And let me know what you think about this one when we get through, and we'll be right back.
Hey, guys. Finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
All right, guys, we have our first repeat guest on the show. Well, I say that, but that's not really true because Andrea Whitney was on, but she doesn't host a podcast. So this is our first repeat podcaster that's on the show. We're going to welcome Lee from Don't Break the Oath podcast, our good buddies from over in Grimsby, England. Lee, how are you doing today, brother?
Yeah, I'm really good. I just wish you'd left that Grimsby bit out.
Well, nobody over here knows, so I'm sure is Grimsby like a bad part of England or something, or does it have a bad reputation?
It's just a shithole.
Well, most people listening probably feel like where they live is a shithole, so it's probably not it.
Oh, well, we're all in the same boat. You make me feel better now.
Right. Well, and you have a co-host on the show, Andy, which is under the weather and couldn't be with us tonight, so his loss, your gain, I guess. You get to talk and hog the whole mic.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful for the opportunity.
So, much to your credit, you guys have been doing this for close to 2 years now, right?
April, yeah. I guess. Probably in different guises, though. I mean, obviously, I started the show with Steve, and I think Andy sort of came into it sort of April time last year. So, yeah, I think I've been doing it nearly a couple of years with Andy. And then a little bit with Steve before that. So, yeah.
Now, you guys, if you was to describe your show, I mean, you talk a little bit about everything from UFOs to paranormal to cryptids, you name it. It's a little bit of everything. You've even had some episodes on like Flat Earth and that type of stuff. So if you was to describe your show to someone that hasn't heard it, how would you best describe it?
Yeah. Well, it is a mixed bag, isn't it? I mean, it's predominantly paranormal.
It's predominantly dogman.
It's predominantly dogman. Well, no, it's predominantly paranormal, but everything ends up being a dogman. And luckily, we won't need to go into dogman today because Andy's not here. So, but no, generally, it is paranormal. Like you say, we cover UFOs and cryptozoology, that kind of stuff as well. Mysteries, we have some guests on that, you know, might bring up something that people might not be aware of, including ourselves, which is always fun. But no, generally it is the paranormal, and it's probably like, 15 other podcasts that people may have listened to on the paranormal. But we sort of give it a different slant based on our paranormal experiences. So we put, if we think something is this way because of something we've experienced, then we'll put that, we'll give our opinion as towards that. But we're not saying we're 100% right. Well, Andy is, but, we're just giving our opinion basically. So you don't just get the story, you get opinions as well. Some you'll like, some you won't, but that's life.
But the reality of it is, and I think I touched on this in one of our previous episodes, is we're all really just giving our opinion. Let's be honest, the paranormal, while most of us believe, it's still not proven. So, for me to say, oh, Susie came in and this ghost came out and this and that, that's really still just an opinion because there's no proof that that ever really happened. We're taking somebody's word for it. So we can't treat it completely as fact ever, I don't think.
No. I suppose what I should maybe a better way to phrase it then is, because we've had paranormal experience ourselves, we don't necessarily go down the skeptical route on a lot of this stuff. We sort of take it as read that these occurrences happen as stated. Obviously, we've had this issue before with people have got in touch with us, but if we're doing a UFO story, okay? So we're not there to talk about this UFO story, then start telling you that it could have been, the Northern Star, it could have been Venus, it could have been this, it could have been swamp gas. We try and assume people think that anyway, so we leave that out. So we give our opinions based on, the paranormal side of the story, if you like,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So let's talk about this real quick because it kind of goes without saying. But you guys have been on the show before. A lot of our listeners already listen to you. But we did get some feedback. You've gotten some feedback that some people felt like the sound quality wasn't totally up to par. You and I have talked about that, and you've taken some steps, and now you've upgraded all your equipment. You've got two or three episodes out on the new equipment. And I think it sounds great. It's a similar setup to what Tracy and I use. And I would just encourage anybody out there, if you listened to the show in the past and that was the deterrent to why you didn't listen, because let's be honest, your content is great. I love the content of the show. It's very enjoyable. But I could definitely understand, if it sounded a little bit of a muffled, why some people would be turned off by that. So to me, that's not that big of a deal. But to some people, it's a huge deal, depending on how they listen to the show. But, that's 100% corrected, and the show sounds absolutely great these days. So I wanted to point that out to anybody who had listened that didn't realize that already.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that. We did take, your advice and others, and we did take steps to put that right. And I think, obviously, some of the shows that are still on the feed, the earlier ones, I've removed a lot of them because of storage reasons, but a lot of the earlier ones do have the shit sound quality, shall we say. So, yeah, but like you say, we've maybe done three or four episodes with the new gear. So at least, if you listen from sort of three episodes back, so I think we're up to 76 or something like that. So if you listen from sort of 70 onwards, you're probably getting the good shit. I'm not saying the what you're going to listen to is good, right. But what I'm saying is the sound quality is good.
Well, like I said, the content's always been good. That's never been an issue. And you're starting, as the show goes on, you're getting better and better guests on also, just like we have. You've got some well-established authors and on everything from UFOs to cryptids and some really good interviews. So if you like that sort of thing, you can definitely get that on your show. Plus, I think you and Andy, your banter back and forth and I won't say arguing, but sometimes it turns into definitely a difference of opinion. I think it really comes across.
It is an argument.
Well, I was trying to be polite, but I think it's
diplomatic.
I think that's part of the charm of the show. That's the parts that I like because you don't always agree.
Yeah. Well, that's what we think, because we think sometimes we come off the mics and we think, I wonder if people were sat at home, you know, maybe two people, you know, I guess it doesn't happen very often where two people might be listening to the same podcast, but we imagine a situation where maybe two or three people are listening to a podcast, and they have a different opinions, because with this paranormal stuff, you know yourself, me and you have got different opinions on certain things as well. So it's not because, you know, it's not like everyone's sort of, oh, we all believe the paranormal, so we all believe this, you know what I mean? It's, you know, like mermaids, you know, I think that's just absolute bullshit. Whereas Andy believes 100% that mermaids are real. So, you know, obviously we've got a difference of opinion there. You know, so that obviously is going to lead to some sort of, argument, isn't it? But we imagine that people at home would have similar differing views, potentially.
So let me make sure we
argue and hope that people are following along the show, arguing as well, with a bit of luck.
So Andy actually believes there are mermaids.
Yep, he's 100% crackers. Well, he said he's on the fence. That's what he said. He's on the fence about mermaids.
God love
him. But I'm not.
Okay, so when we talked earlier in the week, you said you were going to work up a story or two for us. So what I'm going to do, since we've talked about your show a little bit and what you guys do, I'm going to let you treat our listeners into a story that you got for us. So I'm just going to turn the microphone over to you, Lee.
Okay. Well, yeah, obviously we spoke earlier in the week, and what I decided to do is we've just recorded an episode which is going to be entitled Ghosts That Kill. Because, again, this crops up every now and again. We'll be talking about a ghost story, a ghost that's got ill intent, whatever. And me personally, I don't believe that ghosts can kill, okay? I don't believe there's such a thing as a bad ghost, even. I stay away from the word demon, okay? But Andy, he believes that there is such a thing as demons. He won't do a Ouija board, for example, that kind of stuff. So obviously we've got different opinions there. So we decided that we'd do a show about stories where a ghost has allegedly killed somebody or had some part in the victim's death, okay? So what I decided to do is, because we've done a show on it, I decided that, you know, I'd come on with you and maybe touch on a couple of these stories and get your opinion on them and that. So shall I start with the first one?
Sure.
Okay. Well, this is the case of the grave of Cal Pruitt. Okay. And this is in your neck of the woods. This is in Kentucky, but it's actually in is it Pulaski County?
Pulaski
is how you say it. Mm-hmm. See, that's why you're here. So, yeah, Pulaski County, this takes place back in 1938. Now, there is a bit of conjecture about that, but I'll get to that later on. Okay. So, essentially, what we've got a guy here called Cal Pruitt, who was a carpenter, okay? And he goes out, usual thing, gets finished early, okay? So, he comes home, walks in the house, expecting to see his missus in the kitchen. She's not there. He goes into the bedroom, and lo and behold, there she is, having it away, bit of the holding out, with somebody else, okay? So there's another man in the bed. Obviously, he's a bit pissed off at this. So he grabs the chain, because obviously you'll know yourself, you've probably got a chain in your bedroom.
But of course.
For whatever reason, he had a chain. Well, don't answer that. But he grabs a chain, he strangles his wife, while this other fella, he jumps out the window and off he scarpers. He strangles his missus to, you know, she obviously dies. At that point, he's, you know, he's grief-stricken and he realises what he's done, and he pulls out his revolver and blows his brains out. Wow. Okay, so they both die at this point. Now, a couple of days later or whatever, they go to bury these two in this cemetery. Now, the wife's family really didn't want this guy to be, obviously there was husband and wife, so there's going to be buried together, and that the family didn't want this guy, you know, who just killed her, to be anywhere near him. So they decided that they'd put him in a different graveyard across town. So that's the first thing that happens. Now, the story got around about this guy and what he'd done, and the urban legend sprung up that, you know, his grave was haunted and all the rest of it. So it starts really in, like say, in 1938, when these three lads decide to go and investigate the grave. Okay, so just three, you know, teenagers messing about, and one of the lads called James Collins decided to show his mates that he wasn't scared of this curse and didn't believe in it. So he picks up a rock and throws it at the gravestone, chipping a piece of the gravestone off. Okay. Now, the reason that was there is because the legend had got around, and apparently this was true, that over the course of a few days that the gravestone had been sitting in the grave, it had actually formed these brown circles, started to form these brown circles on it, and they'd link together to resemble a chain actually on the gravestone itself. So that's why people were curious to go out there and have a look. So this little lad, James Collins, he chips a bit of this gravestone off. He says, I'm not afraid of any ghost. Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, so he jumps on his bicycle and he's biking home, when all of a sudden his bicycle chain breaks free and manages to wrap around his throat and strangle him. Okay, so he dies. So then we get James's mother. Okay, she goes to bury her son. She hears about how this apparently came about, this was part to do with the curse, the lads tell her. So she's obviously grief-stricken at the time. She decides she's going to go and destroy this grave in her anger, okay? So she grabs an axe, shoots off to the grave, and smashes it into very small pieces. She goes home, she feels much better. She has a drink and all the rest of it. Anyway, next day is just an ordinary day, so she's going to do the laundry, okay? So she goes out. She starts picking up the laundry on the line. When the line breaks, or she trips into it, it's not clear which, she trips into the line, let's say, and the line breaks and coils around her neck. And obviously then she's got, it's tethered at one end, the weight of the washing on the other end. The more she struggles, the tighter it gets. And obviously she dies. Okay, so another victim of the grave. Now, it's alleged that when the people came to investigate, the police or whatever came to look at this situation, they found the axe that she, the very same axe that she'd used to break that grave. Okay, still had the granite or whatever, the dust all over this axe. And everyone knew that she'd gone and done this because she told people she was going to do this. So these two police officers have to go and investigate the grave, because you're not actually allowed to go and smash graves up, even if the ghost killed one of your relatives, okay?
No kidding. Is that just an English thing? Or because I think we do that here.
It's probably different in America. But, so the police officers go to investigate the grave. Now, one of the police officers didn't believe this. You know, he thought it was baloney, the curse is no such thing. Whereas the other officer, he was a bit more of a believer, shall we say. So he didn't want anything to do with it, really. And when they get there, the grave's still intact. It's perfectly intact. There's not a chip in it. There's not anything. But the chain marks are still there. But apart from that, the grave itself is intact, which, you know, should be impossible. But obviously, we're talking about a cursed grave. So anyway, they take photos and all the rest of it at the gravestone. You know, he sits on it and I don't care. I'll sit on the grave, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, they leave the grave, the cemetery, and they're driving back when they notice a bright light in the rearview mirror. Now, at first they think it's just another car or some sort of glare reflection of something, but it's coming from the cemetery, way on. So the driver gets a bit spooked by this, because now he's a bit, maybe the curse was real kind of thing. So he starts speeding up. Well, obviously the passenger's telling him to slow down to stop, but he's not going to do it. But this light's following him. It's getting closer and closer. So he comes driving more erratic, more speed, and eventually he leaves the road and plows into a fence. The passenger, the guy who believed, the curse was most likely true, he flies through the windscreen, lands in the field. After a short while, he manages to gather himself, get his self together, and he's mostly unarmed. He's just got cuts and bruises. But he walks back to the car to see if his friend's okay. And obviously, on looking in the car, he realizes that his friend is almost decapitated, because he's managed to, these two fence posts that they crashed into had a chain across them, that chain again, and that managed to almost decapitate his friend. Okay. So, weird's really getting around now, And most people are staying away from this grave at this point. But every now and again, you get somebody, a bit of bravado, you know, and this turns out to be this farmer. Now, this farmer and his family were riding past, there was on a horse and buggy, riding past the grave. And he says that, you know, I'm not afraid of this curse and all that. So he draws his revolver and fires a few shots into the grave, obviously damaging it in the process. Well, firing a revolver of any, or any gun, to be frank, while sitting on a horse-drawn carriage is not the most sensible thing to do, because the horses get spooked, okay? Right. And they take off running, yeah? You know how easily horses are spooked, so off they go. Now, it's... Some accounts say the family jumped off in the panic. Some accounts say that the horse and buggy crashed and the family managed to come off unharmed. Okay, but the farmer himself, he was flung over the top of the horses, tangled up in their reins, and as the horses run away or bolted, he was strangled to death. So another victim of the grave. Let me come on to the final victim of the grave. And this is a guy called Arthur Lewis. Now, apparently this guy, he'd heard about the curse and all the rest of it, and he was another one, he didn't believe it. I don't know why people just don't believe it and just stay away from it, you know, but for whatever reason, these people who don't believe it need to prove that they don't believe it. So Arthur Lewis, he has a few drinks, I'm sure, and this night he decides he's going to go and destroy the grave. Okay, so he goes set with his hammer and his chisel, and he goes to the grave and he starts whacking it. The grave, I mean. So he starts banging away at the grave, and the people in the vicinity could hear the noises of the hammer and chisel striking the, you know, the granite or whatever the gravestone was made of. And they say that the whacking of the hammer was replaced shortly thereafter by screams, and then the screams all of a sudden stopped. So a couple of the local villagers, if you could call them, you know, grab the torches and the pitchforks and they shoot out there to see what's going on. And they find him laid by the gates of the cemetery. Now, the gates were slightly ajar, but they had a chain round them, okay? But he managed to just prise them open enough to get through. And anyway, on the way out, from whatever scared him or whatever he was running from, he managed to run into this chain. And obviously, they're not sure whether that was what killed him or whether he had an heart attack because of the shock. We don't know, but we just know that he was found at the gates of the cemetery, with chain marks around his throat from running into him, and dead. So another victim of the grave. Okay, so at this point, apparently, it's said that the people who... this is not a very big grave, okay, at the time. I don't think there was many people really living in this particular area. But the graveyard had obviously a few bodies in it. And people started exhuming the bodies of their relatives and moving them out of this graveyard because they didn't want to be in the same graveyard as what was going on. And eventually, the only grave left in there was Cal Pruitt's. Now, it's said that the local... I don't know if you call it a counselling... America, but you know, the local governors or whatever, they decided to remove the gravestone once and for all and put an end to this. So they removed it, and it said that a mining operation a couple of years later came through there and tore up the ground, and you know, so it's lost now, it's lost to history. So that put the end there to the curse. So what do you make of that?
I don't know if I believe any of that. No, I'm just playing with you. I mean, I'm really big when it comes in all these, whether you want to call them coincidences or, I mean, I don't know, like you, if I believe someone can, a ghost can kill you from beyond the grave, but I also don't think that everything is a ghost. I think there are demons. I think that there are, evil presences. So do I think that something could definitely lead a hand into something like that? I absolutely do, because if you go into the whole Bell Witch story, that supposedly is what happened when she killed John Bell, was all from supposedly done beyond the grave. So I do believe it can happen, but I don't think typically ghosts in general are all nice. I think some of them are evil. So I don't doubt that that can happen. I don't know that that's what happened there, but I don't doubt that that could happen.
Mm, yeah, the bell witch, she poisoned him, didn't she?
Yep.
Allegedly. Well, I'm not sure whether to believe this. Like you say, there's a lot of coincidences here, and a few people have done a little bit of digging on this to try and see if it was actually a real story. Now, it's meant to have taken place in 1938, but apparently, looking at the records and that, there's no mention of a guy dying by the name Cal Pruitt in 1938. But the closest they could find was in 1910. There was a guy called Enos C. Pruitt, spelled different. The original guy's name apparently was spelled P-R-U-I-T-T. This guy's name was spelled P-R-E-W-I-T-T. So it's a different spelling, but, you know, Enos, is it C. Pruitt? So he could have gone by Cal Pruitt, okay? And this guy was 44 when he died, and he died by a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. So, you know, it sort of resembles the story in a little way. And the only other death fact sort of can be associated with this in that time frame was a guy by the name of Whitley, who died on July 6, 1914, so 4 years after this guy died. And he was the farmer that crashed his buggy and died. So historically, it doesn't tie up to, you know, the dates given in this particular account, but we do have people with very similar names dying, you know, obviously a few years earlier. But again, that's how urban legends spread, in it. So there could have been some truth to this story, you know, in some shape or form.
So, you know, it's funny because that's a story that's, I've been to Pulaski County. It's actually not that far from my house. It's literally an hour and 15, 20 minutes from where I live. I've never heard that story before. And you're 4,000 miles away and you knew the story. So that's what's cool about all these stories as far as, you know, how you find out about them and who doesn't know about them. So that's kind of an amazing deal when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, just on that point, really, I mean, I heard, this is going to sound crazy, but a few years back, maybe 5, 6, 7 years, something like that, a guy told me that he'd seen this creature. Now, we've got a little woods in the back of Grimsby. It's called Willesby Woods. And this guy reckons that when he was a kid, maybe he was like, 13-year-old, something like that. And he was having a crafty cigarette at the back of the woods with his mates. And they said they were stood there and they was all being quiet because they didn't want anybody to know they was there, okay? So this is during school time. This is like dinner time. They just come out of school to have a crafty fag. Anyway, they're all there being quiet, smoking this cigarette. When they hear this stomping coming towards them, and obviously, when you're a kid and you're smoking a cigarette, you think it's a teacher. So they all hunker down and they're listening for these footsteps, and they get closer and closer and closer. As to eventually they see that it was a cornfield at the back of the woods there, and they see the corn starting to part. So someone's coming through the corn. So they all, you know, they're all fixed on this corn. The footsteps are getting closer and closer. And he says that what came out of that corn was a 4.5 to 5 foot tall figure. Okay. At the lower half was like that of a deer or a goat. It had the, you know, the animal legs with the hooves. The torso was human. The arms were human. And the head was that of a, well, he described it looking like a rabbit slash goat slash deer. It was that sort of shaped face. Okay. It had glowing eyes and it had horns, big, huge horns. Came out of the cornfield, saw them, they saw it, and it just turned round and bolted back into the corn. And they heard it go quite a ways before they couldn't hear it anymore. Now, he told me this story, and I thought it was full of shit. I'm going to be honest. I thought, don't sound very convincing. Anyway, a couple of years after that, you know, so this had gone out of my memory and all the rest of it, and he was sat in a cafe with another friend, and he was talking to this friend about this particular incident, when this woman turned round from another seat in the cafe, she heard them talking about it, and she said, "Did you see that near Willesby Woods?" And he said, "Yeah, that was in Willesby Woods when we saw it." And she said, "I saw exactly the same figure when I was, like, you know, a little girl. In the same place, she saw it maybe 5 or 6 years before he saw it." Again, you know, we've got two stories now from two independent witnesses, if you like, talking about the same creature in the same vicinity. Okay, so then I start talking about this to people. And, you know, Andy mentions that. He says, it's funny you mention that, because when we was growing up, at the back of our ways, and these woods at the back of where he grew up used to be interconnected with this particular wood back in the day. But obviously, you know, the area is built up now, so there's houses and roads in between. But in this particular section of this wood, there was a bit called Devil's Dyke. And you're probably familiar with, you know, when an area's got the word devil in it, there's normally good reason for that devil to be put there. Okay, so this was called Devil's Dyke. And now, when he was growing up, he just thought it was given that name to keep you away from it, you know, to scare kids away from it, because it was a dangerous area. It was, you know, it was a dyke. But it turns out, from talking to his cousin at the time, that someone had actually seen a creature that resembles this creature that I've described earlier, actually at this place, and that's how it got its name, the Devil's Dyke. So I'm telling this to a friend of mine, and he says, you're fucking joking. I says, no, honestly, this is, you know, three different people have told me about this now. And he says, one of my friends told me about this, and he thought he was making it up. He thought it was full of shit. But what he said, he happened, is he was walking his dog around the back of Woolsey Woods, and these two people approached him, running, panics, you know, ashen white, running towards him, saying, run, run, run. And obviously, this is England, you know, we've got no dangerous wild animals or anything like that. So he didn't know what was going on. So he's just there with his dog. These people run towards him, you know, let's say a husband and wife, male and female, run towards him, and they said, run, 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 we've just seen the devil. And obviously, you run with them. Back towards the car park, and he's saying obviously eventually they slowed down, and he said, what did you see? And they described exactly the same figure, but they didn't mention the glowing eyes. But apart from that, they described the same figure in slight, this is probably, I don't know, maybe 1,000 yards away from the original sighting, if you like, but the opposite side of the woods, you know, obviously in the same woods. Anyway, that guy was talking, and it turns out that a friend of his also saw a creature, but this was at night time, and he was just finishing off some gardening work for one of his customers, and he just leant against the fence. This is at the woods that used to adjoin to this particular woods back in the day. Like I said, I don't anymore. But he was resting against his fence post, you know, having a cigarette, you know, finished his day, and he heard this thing approaching him in this dyke. You know, this Devil's Dyke, what's there? He heard it approaching him, and it came up, and he said he could just make out as a shadowy figure, but he could see the red glowing eyes looking back at him. You know, so you take one story, but to get 4 or 5 people saying a similar thing in the same area, independent of each other, you know, that's the reason that I enjoy the paranormal.
Well, I mean, and I see that. I guess what I got out of the conversation is you said you guys don't have any wild animals over in England, and I think you're not including the dog man, which is made clear by Andy, roams all the forest over there.
That's everywhere. He sees it in supermarkets. It's been
there. Yeah. he just got a big beard, Andy. He's not a dog man.
Yeah. Kill him! But yeah, but no, yeah, I know, obviously, you know, yeah, now, knowing this Dogman is allegedly roaming around the British Isles. I was speaking to someone just the other week, and you know, she collates, you know, cryptid encounters. She actually collates them all into like a map, if you like. And do you know how many Bigfoot sightings she's recorded in the UK? Just have a guess.
3.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought she'd have 10 or 15, something like that, maybe. She's actually got over 400 reports of a Bigfoot white creature seen in the UK. Obviously, I'm not saying that they're all true, but you know, when she told me that number, that, you know, blew my mind. Anyway, that's cryptozoology. How did we get onto that?
Well, we start talking about dogmen again, as it usually turns out on your show. Did you say you had another story besides the Kentucky one?
Yeah, I could give you another one. This one didn't make it onto our show, so it's an exclusive for you. I'll save you all the best bits and just let me find it. This is the story of the Undertaker's Bride. Are you familiar with this one?
No.
uh, Yeah, it's probably not for kids, this one. So if there's any kids listening, turn up. So this happens in the fall of 1911 in London. Okay. And it centers around this fella called Edmund Smith, who was an undertaker, the local undertaker. Now, we all know, generally, undertakers are weirdos. And this Smith was no exception to the rule. He goes into the local pub, has a few drinks, gets pretty hammered, and starts boasting while he's still drinking in the pub to his friends and people around that he was enjoying cardinal relations with the young women whose bodies he was taking care of at the mortuary. Yep. So he actually put it like this. He said, this particular day, he said, I have sampled a beauty who drowned on the eve of her wedding. Okay. And she was actually to be buried in a bridal dress. So, yeah, not the most wholesome of characters, is he? But a few weeks later, he's in the pub again, and he comes in and he's, the look of terror on his face, and the friends ask him, to say, what's wrong with you, And this guy's used to seeing dead bodies and that, so he don't normally get shot, but he says, this particular woman appeared to him in his home. She appeared to him decked out in a rotting wedding dress, and she begged him to come with her. She actually said to him, don't you want to be with us? Don't you want to be with me together forever, my sweet? Because he's been, doing the holding out of her. Now she's fell in love with him. So the friends didn't know what to make of this. And he had a few drinks and he left the pub. He didn't come back for a few days and he was in there quite regular. So people got a bit worried and went round to his house. And eventually the police and some friends broke into the house to find a very grisly sight. They found the undertaker, this Smith, sprawled on the bed. His neck was broken, and an expression of raw horror was frozen upon his face. On the bedside, next to him, was the bridal veil. Dun, dun, dun. What do you make of that?
I mean, I guess my question is, what do most of these dead bodies look like? Are they at least attractive?
Well, yeah, I mean, she drowned, so there wouldn't be much wrong with her.
Well, I mean, but some of those, depending on how long they were in water, could be like, bloated and unrecognizable. So maybe I'm digging too deep into this.
Yeah, maybe. I think it must go on, though, mustn't it?
it definitely goes on. I mean, there were stories back when Marilyn Monroe was taken to the coroner's office. There were stories that somebody who worked there, tried to do some stuff to her. It's a sad world we live in. So none of that actually surprises me. Lee,
I was going to say, just so he can tell his friends that he slept with Marilyn Monroe. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter that it was after she was dead, still.
Oh, he leaves that bit out.
Yeah. That part doesn't get mentioned. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how these guys can listen to your show. I mean, they know how to listen to podcasts, so that really goes without saying. I hate when people say that. It's on iTunes and all the other platforms, but tell them how they can interact with you more. I know you got some groups and stuff out there.
Yeah, we have a Facebook group called the Don't Break the Oath Podcast Paranormal Hangout. And really that's, it is for the show, but it's not just solely about the show. It's not people just on there saying, "Oh, this is a wonderful podcast." It's in fact, it's nobody on there saying that. but it is a place where people can share the paranormal stories and feelings and all the rest of it. And then if we do a show where people want to, mention something about the show, something we missed off or something we said or whatever, and that goes on there as well. So really, there's that. And then obviously, if people want to send us the stories, they just send them to dbtopodcast@gmail.com. And then if they want to look at the website, that is just Don't Break the Oath Podcast, all one word or phrase, if you will, .com.
And you've got a new shop up too, right?
Yeah. We've moved shops now. We were on the same shop as what you guys use. Seems to be pretty sweet. Looking at it. So yeah, if people want to get something in time for Christmas, they probably missed the boat, to be honest. I think it's getting a bit close now, but if they want to get on there and get a latte mug with Don't Break the Oath on it, why would you? I don't know. But if you do, the shop is there for you.
Yeah, we
had, I know you've got two.
We had somebody buy a shower curtain, so I can't say that.
Yeah, I heard that on the show, yeah.
And then somebody else already asked me about it. He's trying to convince his wife to let them buy one. So now it's become kind of a thing. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's shower curtain in every state.
Yeah, that would be awesome. well, brother, we appreciate
it. You should have a map on your website.
Yeah. Yeah. These are all the states that we still need somebody to. Wisconsin, I need you to buy a shower curtain. Thank you so much for coming on. I wish Andy could have been a part of it, but hey, I understand how it is to be sick. But the reality of it is, it was still fun. And I think the tone of the show, of your show, still came through exactly because I felt like I was listening to Don't Break the Oath while you were telling your stories and giving your little summarizing statements of your thoughts of the story. So if you're listening and haven't listened to Don't Break the Oath, that's kind of what you get, except you get two of them going back and forth. And that part actually even adds to it. So, but I thought it really came across well as far as showing people what your show was like if they hadn't heard it. And I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, anytime, mate.
And I'm glad that you got new sound equipment because now I'll start listening to the show again. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
So you're the one that dropped off, are you?
All right, brother. Well, I greatly appreciate it. Tell Andy I said hi, and looking forward to great things from you guys.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll speak before Christmas, but I just want to wish you and Tracy a very Merry Christmas.
And the same to you guys, Lee.
Cheers, matey.
All right, thank you. I really do love their show. I mean, they had sound quality problems, and I know that's a pain for most people. It was the same way with me. I struggled to listen sometimes to it, but now it is 10 times better now, and I'm so glad.
Yeah, it sounds really great.
And, you know, I talked to Lee here a little bit shortly ago, and he
a
was
a little bit shortly ago.
Yeah, that's a word, right?
But that totally did not make sense.
Okay. I talked to him a long time ago, and I talked to him earlier today, and he was telling me that their listens have almost doubled what they were 3 weeks ago.
Good for you guys. That's great.
Yeah, it's coming completely back up. And it's all got to do with the sound quality. He knows it. So.
Well, good. You guys deserve it.
Sound quality and dog man. That's all they talk about on that show.
Is that right?
Yeah, everything turns out to be a dog man. It could be a UFO. It's a dog man flying it. I mean, it's just...
Hey, that's what you believe in, right?
That's right. But we're gonna do some more stuff on Dogman. I've got some guys from the North American Dogman Project that's not too far from us. I think they're up in the Cincinnati area, so it's only a couple hours away. And I'm going to try to get them on the show. We talked to them at Scarefest, and it's a long time coming. But they've got some cool stories. So the whole, you know, if you get into the Bigfoot and werewolves and all that stuff, they've got a cool story that happened in Kentucky where they've actually got a documentary out where supposedly this guy saw this werewolf type creature just tear a couple of people apart.
Oh my God.
But there's still no record of it. So it's one of those funny, he saw it, he knows what he saw, but there's no record of it. So is there a cover up? I don't know.
Oh, I hope that didn't happen. That's really not good.
We'll get them on after the first of the year and have them tell you the story because when he told it to me, I was like, I couldn't. It sounded almost too unbelievable, but you know, so many conspiracies and cover ups are. So what are you going to say? Well, guys, we're going to wrap this night up. We hope you enjoyed everything that we had for you tonight. I think you're going to enjoy what we got for you next week, like I said earlier. So a little bit of true crime facts, a little bit of Andrea Whitney and telling her story. And I'm telling you, I know I keep teasing this, but her story, I'm just going to give you a tidbit of what it is. She actually had a friend that supposedly committed suicide. There was a lot of questions about whether that was actually happened or not. There was questions about whether the police investigation was done properly. It's a small town, so a lot of things could happen. And she's decided to look into it on her own. And there's a bunch of paranormal things that have happened.
Oh, that's awesome.
To kind of point her in different directions.
That's awesome.
And the story that she told me, it was one of the most awesome stories I've ever heard.
Oh, wow.
So... you know, I think back to if you've seen the movie with Kevin Bacon. What was that movie? You remember?
Was it a movie or a TV show.
No, it was the movie where the little girl was killed in the neighborhood, and he got hypnotized, and he could start seeing things, and she was coming to him to try to help him
solve
the murder.
That's very cool, though.
That was an awesome movie, and this when she started telling me some of the things happening, that's what it reminded me of was that movie. So, but yeah, that was actually Stir of Echoes is what that's called.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Stir of Echoes. But the things she was telling me was similar to type things that you would see in a movie like that, to where somebody's reaching out from beyond the grave to try to help find out what really happened. And the incidents that she'll tell you about are just amazing. So I can't wait to do that. So, hey, how about that for a fun Christmas?
Nice.
Yeah. We got serial killer, fun serial killer facts, and people reaching out from beyond the grave to solve that. And we're going to have some scary Christmas stories, some paranormal stuff that's happened at Christmas time.
All right. Sounds great.
One of them, I can already tell you, involves a boy and his 7-year-old dead friend.
Aww.
But it's a very cool story. So it's kind of scary. You might start crying on that one, too.
I will not.
All right, guys. We love you, and we'll see you soon.
Love you guys. Have a good week.
Hey, guys. Have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.